Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, they've finally just laid it right out. There's no way to avoid it any longer. No way to pretend that they're in favor of democracy or republic or the rule of law. No, the Bushies have come right out and said, now we just believe we're above the law, period. Forget about those founding fathers. Welcome to the program. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, AirAmericaRadio.com, CRN Digital. Welcome to the program. There really is no third way anymore. You can't ignore it. And as Chris Floyd points out in his blog today, brilliantly written, you can't ignore it, and you can't deny it. I mean, they've come right out and said, you know, yeah, we broke the law. So what? Amazing. Amazing. So we thought we would turn to Evan Sayet, a reliable Republican commentator, conservative commentator, I should say. Evan Sayet, EvanSayet.com, his website and his blog. And Evan, if the Republican Party is going to try to continue to claim that they love America, why are they working so hard to destroy the middle class, wipe out our freedom from the intrusion of big government that our founders fought and died for, and destroy America's reputation around the world?
Because that's just an inaccurate spin on the reality. Nobody's come out and claimed we're above the law. Quite the opposite. We've said, hey, this is what we did. And, by the way, this is also what Bill Clinton argued for, and Jamie Gorelick.
It's not what Bill Clinton did.
And even the
It is not what Jimmy Carter did. You know that those claims have been discredited. It is not what Bill Clinton did. It is not.
Wait.
George W. Bush is the
what
first.
What you mean is that somebody from your side said something and you just accept it as true because there's no critical thinking going on. Look, this has been done and this has been tried.
Evan, you are suggesting to me that are you trying to trot out this old canard that Jimmy Carter did it and Bill Clinton did it? Is that what you're saying?
They both argued specifically for.
Oh, so now it's not that they did it; it's that they argued in favor of it.
Okay,
but they didn't do it.
Yeah. Okay. It doesn't matter. They argued specifically for it.
So I argue on this program regularly that I think prostitution should be legalized and so should pot. But I'll tell you, they're both illegal. You're not going to find me down at the local.
There's a difference here, Tom. You are arguing for what should be, and they were arguing for what is. You know, and for you to just leap not only to the conclusion that this is a crime, but that this is a crime of all magnitudes, so they don't care about democracy. Before, it reminds me of our conversation about Karl Rove. You know, and meanwhile,
Evan, it's not me jumping to this conclusion. It's Senator Lindsey Graham, the Republican from South Carolina, who led the impeachment against Bill Clinton.
How many Democrats have come out?
It's conservative George Will. It's former Reagan Deputy Attorney General Bruce Fein. It's American Enterprise Institute scholar Norm Ornstein.
Well, then let's try it in the courts, my friend. But for you to already ahead of time not only convict the president, obviously he believes he's on firm ground. He wouldn't have come out.
No, he doesn't. He then came out the next day and said, you got to know, when we talk intelligence, we're talking about actually getting warrants. On day one, he says, no, we don't need them. We're covered by the Constitution. And then the next day, he says, oh, we always get them. He's lying to us.
There was never any such claim. The reality is...
Would you like me to play you the audio clips?
Yeah, play me the audio clips.
Okay, well, it's going to take a minute to cue them up. So anyhow, you continue with your rant. And,
right. When I speak, it's a rant. When you speak that...
No, when I speak, it's a rant, too. I'll tell you, Evan. We both got rants. So, as you were saying, I was asking you to tell us how it is that the Republican Party can claim to be pro-American when they are in the process of trying to take apart the middle class in America and thumbing their nose at the rule of law.
It's just such a lunatic statement. They're trying to take apart the middle class. Then why do 70% of all people now own their own homes? I mean, those are the facts. Take apart the middle class.
Those people do not own their own homes, Evan. They own their own mortgages.
Well, so
the
what?
Banks own their
rather,
homes.
I would rather own a mortgage and then collect equity as I pay my rent than just give the money to a landlord and have no equity. So you have to look at play.
But the problem is that fully a third of those mortgages that were issued last year have no equity provision in them. They're interest-only mortgages. People are not acquiring equity. Basically, what we're looking at here, Evan, is a tax break for the middle class, something that I thought you would be opposed to because it's a special interest tax break for people who are not millionaires and billionaires. And that is the home mortgage interest deduction.
No clue. As millionaires and billionaires, that's just a buzz phrase that you use. Millionaires and billionaires are not the ones who are benefiting. It's across the board. Everybody has benefited.
Everybody has benefited. You realize since George Bush came into office, real wages in the United States for everybody. This is according to the Congressional Budget or to the General Accountability Office, completely nonpartisan. Since George Bush came into office, real wages for the bottom 95% of households in America have declined. Only for the top 1% have they actually increased.
I have no knowledge of that report, so I can't discuss it with you.
Let me play you the audio of Bush, first of all, saying we don't need no stinking FISA warrants. Okay, here he is. This is, hang on just a second. I got to plug in the right wire here. There we go. Here we go. Here's George Bush.
Quick to detect and prevent. We use FISA still. You're referring to the FISA court in your question. Of course we use FISA. But Pfizer's is for long-term monitoring. What is needed in order to protect the American people is the ability to move quickly to detect.
Now, first of all, we know that that's a lie because Pfizer allows, retroactive warrants. But anyhow, continuing with his little...
When he suggested this idea, I then obviously went to the question, is it legal to do so? I swore to uphold the laws.
Actually, he swore to uphold the Constitution, but anyway.
Do I have the legal authority to do this? And the answer is absolutely.
And authority
as I mentioned
from?
In my remarks, the legal authority is derived from the Constitution.
But there you go again, though.
As well as the authorization of force by the United States Congress.
You're trying to filibuster George Bush?
No, I didn't realize you're still playing it.
Okay. Now here, that was when he says he has the authority. Here, a day later, he says, actually, we always get warrants.
Now, by the way, anytime you hear the United States government talking about wiretap, a wiretap requires a court order. Nothing has changed, by the way. When we're talking about chasing down terrorists, we're talking about getting a court order before we do so.
Evan?
He didn't contradict himself in the slightest. You see, what you're trying to pull is the wool over your listener's eyes. Because there are two different issues here. There are two different issues here. When we wiretap, but the other thing we're talking about is data mining. So when he was data mining and when he was using this new technology that FISA in 1978 didn't anticipate, the law was, and he went to his lawyers, and by the way, the same arguments that others have made along the way. And look, the law is such that there are gray areas, and I want my president to go as far as the law allows, but not an inch further.
We are talking in both cases about wiretapping. By the way, we're speaking with Evan Sayet, evansayet.com, his blog, noted conservative commentator and comedian. Have you? Last time I talked with you, Evan, you were doing a Friars Club thing down in L.A.
Yeah, and that just went spectacularly well.
You still doing that gig? That kind of stuff?
I'm sorry?
Are you still doing that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I do it about once a month. I just got home. I was on a 31-day tour of the military bases, so I didn't do it last month.
Yeah,
but,
well,
yeah.
Good on you for that, and people can find out about that at your blog. Okay, so, Evan, you say that the Democrats here in this Times treason likely in cahoot with Dems, and that the New York Times and the Democrats are part of a hate America conspiracy.
Oh, I have no doubt about that.
And
by the way, it doesn't give me any pleasure to say that.
Do you mean they hate the land of America? They hate the people of America? They hate the Constitution? What part of America is it that you think that the Democrats hate?
Well, first of all, the powers that be, the elitists, the academics and whatnot, hate middle America. They hate.
No, wait a minute. You just named three different... The powers that be, you're talking about the Bush administration?
No, I'm talking about the powers that be within the Democratic Party. I'm talking about Howard Yeehaw Dean, who says, "I hate Republicans," quote-unquote. Well, Republicans make up a very large percentage. I believe the Republicans won 2,500 out of 3,000 counties. And here the head of the Democratic Party, quote, unquote, "I hate Democrats."
You realize you're taking that wildly out of context.
Not in the slightest.
Okay. In any case, so you think that the Democratic hatred of America, in your mind, is a hatred of what, specifically?
The elite believe that middle America, you know, what's the matter? Like there's something the matter with Kansas. Kansas being a microcosm of America. They think they're stupid because they believe in God. They think they're bigoted.
No, I think they think that they're misinformed because they vote for a guy who then screws them economically. That being George W. Bush. I mean, he says, oh, I'm going to give you a tax break. Here's $300. Vote for me.
Exactly,
and then he gives billions to his buddies.
Well, that's not exactly true. That's your spin on it.
And the $300, by the way, was something that Bernie Sanders attacked on.
Here's the problem, that because liberals don't have any real values, because they're valueless, the idea that people should...
You mean George Washington had no values? You're saying the people who founded this liberal democracy in the United States had no values?
Those were not modern liberals. Those were not modern liberals. They didn't seek to undermine...
The values of modern liberals, Evan, are absolutely no different whatsoever than the values of the liberals who founded this country, in my opinion.
No, but not modern liberalism. Just because you guys are called liberals now, Union satellite states call themselves democratic republics.
Yeah. Evan, stick around for a second. We'll continue this right after the break. It's 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, it seems like the whole damn world's gone wrong. St. Joe McCarthy is dead and gone. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News. Don't try to change my mind with facts. To hell with the graduated income tax. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News. Daily News.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman radio program, helping you win the water cooler wars of uncommon sense in the radical middle. Welcome back to our program. For the next few minutes here, we're going to be to the bottom of the hour talking with Evan Sayet, EvanSayet.com. Evan, I got to say, in my opinion, conservatives are peddling what they call morality. You were asking about liberal values, what they call morality, which is about what people do in private. They want to know what people are doing in their bedrooms and if they're doing it in the right position with the right person. And I would suggest that liberal progressive morality is about public morality. What we are, if there are hungry among us, if there are thirsty.
I couldn't disagree more, Tom. I mean, that's the caricature. But I couldn't care less what people do in the privacy. What I care about is that when America is at war against people who have declared jihad and seek to saw our heads off, we don't misrepresent the payments to Halliburton like Jim Hightower just did, from Halliburton to the vice president, and he's still being paid $150,000 a year. No, he's not. That's old deferred payments that have absolutely nothing to do.
Yeah, and he's being paid. Can you imagine, Evan? I just have to say, I know the answer I'll get from you, so I'll just pose this rhetorically.
Okay.
If Al Gore had been getting a deferred payment salary every year from, say, the tobacco industry every year that he was vice president, and say the Clinton administration had just been happenstance working on behalf of the tobacco industry real heavily.
Okay.
That guy would be dragged before Congress for impeachment so fast it would make your head spin. Evan, let's take a couple calls from our callers here.
That's a rhetorical question because your answer is not what my answer would be.
Okay.
You're leaving out the fact that President Clinton used Halliburton in no-bid contracts in more places, more times than this president.
Oh, I know, because Dick Cheney was there lobbying for it. He was president of the company.
Lobbying to Clinton. So when Clinton does it, it's Cheney's fault. When Bush does it, it's Cheney's fault.
No, Evan, if you want to have a Let's Criticize Clinton club here, I'll be at the front of the line.
Okay, fair enough.
Matt in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, you're live with Evan Sayet. Hey, Matt, welcome to the program.
Hi, guys. How is everything?
Good. What's up?
Thanks. I just want to make a point to Evan let's just take the argument here for a second that Clinton did it and Carter did it, right?
No, my argument is that they argued the legalities of it.
Yeah, neither one of us are saying that they did it.
Okay.
They trotted that out for a day or so. Fox News trotted it out, and then everybody retracted it.
Okay, so they
Nobody
argued for it.
It.
And this, in some way, clears
they stopped
Bush's
saying.
Name, right?
I'm sorry?
And this, in some way, clears Bush's name. Is that right?
No, you know what? Let's instead of jumping on the idea that he's admitted guilt and that he doesn't care and that now there's no third way any longer, let's weigh that out, just like on a previous program where we went through and viciously attacked Karl Rove, and now that everything's out there, there was nothing to it.
There
was nothing to it. It's this hyperbole. It's this never looking left. It's attacking the
hyperbole,
but letting Sandy Berger
hyperbole. You're the one saying
documents down his
us
pants.
Liberals hate America. Please, please, please,
okay.
Calm down. Now, the thing I want to know is if they argued for it, all you're doing is equivocating Bush's fault at it.
Yeah.
He is just as liable for legality.
Yeah, and two rights don't make it wrong.
If you want to bring it up in Congress, in court, whatever, we should do that. So
absolutely.
I don't see where your argument sticks.
The problem, and Matt, you make a great point, and thank you very much. I got to move along. The problem, Evan, is that there will be no investigation as long as the Republicans control both the House and Senate, which is one of the reasons why we...
There was no investigation into Karl Rove. There was no investigation into 9/11. There was no investigation into...
Not any meaningful investigation, in my opinion. Dan in Gaylord, Michigan, you're live with Evan Sayed.
The conclusion you
Hi,
want.
Tom, hey,
Dan.
Thanks for doing what you do, and you are the Iron Man of radio. I think you've been told that before.
Oh, thank you. By the way, I should put our phone number out here. It's 866-440-THOM, 866-440-8466, if you want to call in here. Go ahead, Dan.
I just wanted to say that, you know, I find it appalling, and I'm somewhat ashamed of my fellow Americans who are arguing against the very system set up in the Constitution of checks and balances in judicial oversight over law enforcement activities, which is what we are engaged in, is a law enforcement activity when we're wiretapping.
No, it's not law enforcement, and that's exactly why Clinton was such a failure, because he dealt with terrorism as a law enforcement thing. Let them blow up the building.
Wait a minute, it was a failure to execute Tim McVeigh?
It's okay.
He found the major terrorist, you know, the major terrorist incident in the United States during his administration. The guy killed several hundred people. He blew up a federal building. He, as a law enforcement incident, Bill Clinton tracked him down, put him in jail. Those families got closure. The incompetent George Bush hasn't even found Bin Laden yet.
But that's so silly. Meanwhile, during the Clinton administration, our embassies were being bombed two by two. So you could point out that he caught a domestic terrorist. Meanwhile, they were blowing up our people in Saudi Arabia under President Bush.
And every time Bill Clinton tried to go after Bin Laden overseas, the Republicans all started yelling, you know, no blood for Monica.
Nobody ever.
It's the tail wagging the dog.
Argument, much less marches in the streets arm in arm with the communists, the fascists.
There were literally chants on the floor of Congress, no blood for Monica, from Republicans who were complaining about Bill Clinton trying to take out Osama bin Laden.
And how many Republicans actually did that take with on the streets? You didn't have hundreds of thousands of people viciously slandering.
No, because Bill Clinton wasn't doing stuff. Bill Clinton wasn't about to lie us into a war. Evan said, Evan, it's a great conversation. You give as good as you get, and I appreciate it. There you go. Thank you. Evan's website, evansayet.com. Evan, thanks for being with us today. Good talking with you, as always.
It's been a great year, man.
You too. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends.
We've taken all you give. It's getting hard to make a living. Mr. President, the pity on the working man.
It's 25 minutes before the hour. And the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, or at least a decent minimum wage, at least a decent social security system, at least a government that doesn't lie to its people, here on the Tom Hartman radio program. Going to drop into our live chat room, go to tomhartman.com. However you spell it will get you there, although the correct spelling is T-H-O-M Hartman with two N's .com. And just click the live chat button, and you can drop in and participate with some of the finest minds on the entire internet. And actually, I am not saying that facetiously. I mean, there's some really brilliant folks in there. In fact, very often I'll have a question and I'll say, well, what's the answer to this on the air? And, you know, 30 seconds later, boing, it pops up on somebody in the chat room knows it. And also, you're welcome to call into our program. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. Greetings, by the way, to Talk 1390 WVAA in Burlington, Vermont. Great to be back on the air in Vermont. In fact, this program started in Burlington, Vermont, 3 years ago, and great to be back. Great to be back. 1-866-440-8466, 440-THOM, our telephone number. Nate in St. Cloud, Minnesota on the line. Hey, Nate, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say, I took constitutional law just a couple years ago, 101, and they teach you right away I don't know how much their information they're going to be able to use if they obtain it illegally, what kind of court case they're going to be able to make anyway. And to me, it seems like George W. Bush, the reason he doesn't want to go ask for warrants is because with this data mining, he'd almost have to ask for a warrant on every American or every person in our country. Isn't he violating our civil rights? I mean,
well, clearly he is, and or at least in my opinion, he clearly is, Nate. And the point that you raise is one that is being raised. I believe it was an op-ed in today's New York Times. It might be in the Washington Post. I read it this morning. Don't have it in front of me. Where one of the big concerns that's being put forward among attorneys inside the Bush administration about the ability of the Bush administration now to prosecute people for terrorism-related crimes is that the evidence that they've gathered on some of these folks, I mean, you know, some of these wiretaps are actually good, legitimate things. We do want our spy agencies to be spying on bad guys. We all agree on this.
Right.
We just want it done in a way that follows the law. And now they may not be able to prosecute some of these guys because they obtained the evidence illegally. And you know, that would be a terrible thing if Bush did this. And you know, if he was doing this like Nixon was, if he was going around these things, because he wanted to spy on John Kerry during the campaign or something like that. I mean, that's out there floating around, and it's a question that hasn't been answered. And if that kind of thing, if political espionage or is simply espionage on dissent is being misused by this government, and as a consequence of that, what is being compromised is our ability to prosecute real live terrorists or real live people who are out to get this country, then that's a disaster. That is a high crime or misdemeanor. Nate, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Some of the folks in the chat room asking, you know, why do you put on conservatives? And, at least once a week or so, I try and get a conservative on the program. We do 15 hours a week of talk radio on this program, noon to 3 Eastern time, Monday through Friday. And I think it's important, frankly, for people to have some sort of a model of how to, on the one hand, win the water cooler wars. You know, we all have conservatives in our lives. My father has been a Republican since I was a little kid. He's got a picture of George Bush. My mother and father have a picture of George Bush on their wall next to the picture of me and my brothers. I mean, we all have conservatives in our lives. We have conservatives at work that we have to work with, things like this. How do you have an argument with a conservative, a debate with a conservative, and not have it turn into name-calling and not have there be blood on the floor at the end of the day? But at the end of the day, you can say, you know, you're still a human being, and I still have some respect for you as a human being, even though politically I think you're off the wall. And, you know, that's the folks from Ayn Rand, Evan Sayet. Evan is one of the more articulate conservatives out there, neocons. I'm not sure exactly how he'd characterize himself, and willing to come on the program. What's tragic, in my opinion, frankly, is that a number of organizations, Heritage Foundation like this, who used to be willing to give us guests to put on to discuss really substantive issues, you know, healthcare issues and things like that, they're afraid to come on the program now. You know, it's and I don't beat people up. I don't call them names. So, but anyway, I want to model how do you win the water cooler wars? That's my goal. In small doses. Brian in Seattle, Washington, 1-866-440-8466. Hey, Brian, welcome to the program.
Hi there. And I was thinking as I was listening to Evan about what the conservative religious values are, and it seems like it's always some kind of hideous, tragic thing that galvanizes, like what he said was they've declared jihad and they want to saw our heads off, and that's really mm-hmm. what the crux is of where he's going through.
Yeah.
And then what also I find is like at my parents' church, they had a little video. They have a little multimedia mega church thing going on there, and then they had a little re-display of the 9/11 flames in church one day.
Right.
And it's kind of like the idea of saying, well, it's like I do have a book here that I checked out of the library. If anyone's taking my library records, it's called The Greatest Spiritual Secret of the Century.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe if you got the hardback, I bet it would be in vellum with raised letters.
Yeah, it's actually not available in hardcover. It's
But I loved it.
Good. Well, thank you. I'm glad you like my book. Thanks for the plug. But anyway, so your point is that the conservative pitch –
Oh, apparently he's dropped off the line, and I didn't dump him. Apparently his point was that the conservative pitch is based in fear, and I think that that is so true. That the conservatives, basically the bottom line is that they're all about, you know, getting afraid, get afraid, be afraid. It's like, you know, that famous speech that George Bush gave before the Republican National Convention, where it's just incredible. I mean, you go through his RNC speech, and it is fear after fear after fear after fear after fear. In fact, you know, one of our listeners had gone through and actually parsed out the speech and taken out the pieces, you know, that were the fear pieces, and just strung them together in chronological order, in the order in which they appeared. And it's actually so incredible how often when Bush, there are certain words, he always uses the exact same tonality, even when he's saying these same words. This is a speech at the Republican National Convention.
Be afraid, September the 11th. We saw tragedy arrive on a quiet morning. The evil terrorists. September the 11th. Danger. Doom. Danger. Doom. Killers. Be afraid. Evil. The world will drift toward tragedy.
And on it goes. I mean, I've got another minute and 42 seconds of this stuff, which I'm not going to inflict all on you, but I'm telling you, it just goes on and on and on. And this is just from one speech.
We have fought the terrorists across the earth.
Yeah, and so anyhow, on he goes. 1-866-440-8466. Luke in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hey, Luke, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hi, Tom. My question is kind of a civil rights question. Is I was thinking about this. Okay, now he's saying now he has the right to suspend the Fourth Amendment at his choosing.
Well, Bush has never come out and said that.
But that's essentially what he's coming out and saying. He has the right to override the Bill of Rights.
Yeah, he's not saying it. He's doing it.
No, I know.
Yeah.
The question is, where's the NRA?
Yeah, good question. Well, the NRA is actually focused, it's just like the ACLU only focuses on the First Amendment. The NRA says they only focus on the Second Amendment. In my opinion, the NRA is really mostly a lobbying agency for gun manufacturers.
Well, but the thing of it is, this is essentially, he's setting the precedent now, so okay, with them, it's like, okay, how would you like it when the Democratic president says, I have to suspend the Second Amendment for terrorism reasons?
Yeah. Yeah. Luke, this would be a good one to bring up over, you know, if you're an NRA member, or for any of our listeners who are NRA members, if the NRA has any kind of a message board on their website or anything like that, to raise the question, you know, because the NRA has talked before about the registration of gun owners not just being a violation of the Second Amendment, but also being a violation of the Fourth Amendment, in their opinion. And this being a Fourth Amendment issue, you raise a good one.
Thanks.
A good one. I appreciate it. Thanks for the call, Luke. Good to hear from you. Lee in Houston, Texas. Hey, Lee, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. How's it going?
Great. What's up?
Oh, nothing. I wanted to call and say thanks, first of all, for you've been a great inspiration for me, man. I've had three articles printed in the Houston Chronicle about topics like this.
Good on you, Lee.
Yeah, I was actually going to send them to you, man. I know you'd be proud of me.
That is great. Well, feel free. I mean, you know, I read my own email, so, you know, send
them. Okay, I'll do that then, man. I've read a couple of your books. You really keep me going, man.
Thank you.
I wanted to call and say that the guy that was on earlier, you guys were hashing it out about Halliburton, and
mm-hmm.
I was hoping to address this to him. Cheney owns 243,000 shares of Halliburton. He made $8 million off last year alone.
Well, yes and no. When he became vice president, he donated those to charity. The problem is that and he signed a document saying, I've given these things to charity. The problem is that according to, I believe, the CBO, one of the agencies of Congress that looks into the legality of things like that, they have said that this isn't quite as airtight as Cheney says it is, and that why didn't he just give them to the charity to begin with, and
this
isn't really a totally legal thing. So there's a debate about whether or not he actually has donated them to charity. But the official Republican position is, yes, his stock options are worth, you know, millions and millions more every year as Halliburton gets more and more of these no-bid contracts, but he's not going to profit from it. We will not know the truth of that until this administration leaves office.
Exactly.
So,
you know, if we're talking about truth, there's really not a whole, you know, how are we going to believe that when they told us the WMDs and we fly people to countries that do torture but don't torture them and blah, blah. It just goes on and on.
Oh, it really does. It really does. And in fact, it's even getting, Lee, thanks a lot for the call from Houston there. It gets even weirder than that. If you don't like the facts, just make stuff up. I'll tell you about this in the next hour. I'm going to take a couple more phone calls here as we go along in this hour. But there is a new right-wing group out there, and they are literally making stuff up and running commercials all across America with it. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Have you seen the little piggies calling in the dark?
Oh, but it's not the little piggies you got to worry about. Get out of Wall Street. You want to see the bigger piggies. Complete with their clean white shirts. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the bigger piggies you got to worry about.
Have you seen the bigger piggies in the starched white shed? You will find bigger piggies staring at the dead. Always have clean shirts.
Yes, walking the halls of Congress in their Gucci shoes. Welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program, Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting. Welcome back to our program, 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number, Joseph in Alexandria, Louisiana. Hey, Joseph, welcome to the program. Joseph, you got to
Yes,
be...
Hi, how are
yeah,
you, sir?
You are live and on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Listen, I'm not trying to compare George Bush to Adolf Hitler by any stretch.
No. Adolf Hitler was a decorated war hero.
Right. No, I'm talking about George W. Bush.
Yeah.
Right. We're not going to go to that. Right. Right. Exactly. Hitler was a decorated war hero.
He won the Iron Cross in World War I. Yeah.
Exactly. So. But, you know, when you look at the emergency powers that we have given the president and this unbridled use of that power that he seems to be exercising with spying and so forth, it reminds me of when the Reichstag burned down and Hitler exercised his emergency powers and essentially started doing the exact same thing.
Yeah, Joseph, you're right. I actually wrote a piece about this, an op-ed piece 2 years ago called When Democracy Failed, which is now a chapter in my book, What Would Jefferson Do?, and pointed out that on February 23rd, 1933, when Marius von der Lubbe set on fire the Reichstaggebäude, the parliament building, the German parliament building, Hitler was having dinner with von Papen and Hindenburg and was trying to talk them into making him chancellor. And he ran over to the front of the, over to the building. They were only about six blocks away. He ran over to the building, gets in front of the radio microphones, and gives this speech about how this fire is a sign from God. This is a exact verbatim quote from Hitler. This fire is a sign from God. This terrorist act will not go unanswered. We will not tolerate terrorism. And he declared a war on terrorism in Germany. And then within 3 weeks, they passed a set of laws called the Laws for the Protection of Patriotic Germans.
Exactly.
Which had a 4-year sunset provision on him. It was the only way he could get it through Parliament that allowed them to look at people's mail, listen to people's telephone conversations, and break into people's homes without warrant or without the person's knowledge, and without warrants. And
you can find that in the Shearer book also.
That's right. Yeah, William Shearer, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. It's all right there. It is the Patriot Act. It was called the Enabling Act actually back then. So yeah, you're absolutely right, Joseph. And I appreciate your pointing it out. I got to move along here. 1-866-440-8466. David in Kent, Washington. Hey, David, you want to disagree with me?
Hey, how's it going, man? I just want to say I like listening to you guys' show. It reveals a lot to me about the left side of America.
Okay.
I want to preface by saying I am a 26-year-old conservative male, married and not gay. So I don't quite fit your demographic for listeners. But I want to say the preface you guys are using for President Bush and his use of fear as a tactic, as a way to get into American hearts, to try to push his agenda on this war, is completely misguided and wrong. In his RNC speech, it's one that you're labeling out, saying, how many times he uses fear, how many times he uses certain key phrases. You guys are cutting out all the important parts, which is the middle part, which is by saying, do not be afraid, you know? The right side of America is not fearful. We don't fear because we're gun-toting Second Amendment protecting Americans. And the left side of America, can you let
May God bless you.
Continue.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, George was...
God, the continuing danger of...
Yeah, make your point, David. Or is that,
okay.
Was that your point? That George is a wonderful, noble leader. He's moving us toward the light rather than away from the darkness.
Okay, I just want to make a quick point by saying that the left side is the fearful side of America, and you guys are using this to instill fear in yourselves, not in the right side of America.
What is the left side fearful of, David? I'm curious.
You're afraid of the right side of America. That's exactly what it all comes
now,
down to.
Now, what of the right side of America are we afraid,
you're afraid of? Christians. You're afraid. No,
I am a Christian, David. I am not afraid of Christians.
You're a Christian, but you're a liberal.
I'm sorry. Jesus was the original liberal, you'll recall. I suggest you go back and read Matthew 5 through 8 and Matthew 25.
Jesus Christ was not political in any way. Let's get that straight, okay? Don't use that. Such a ridiculous statement.
The fundamentals.
Unbelievable with this. He is not a liberal.
The fundamentals of liberal values are to be found in the Gospels if you want to get into religion. You can also find them in the Old Testament as well. You can find them in Judaism. You can find them in Islam. You can find them in all major religions.
Let's not make it religious. Let's make it American. Let's make it patriotic then. Let's make it an argument for the right side of America. Look, we are the ones who are gun-toting Second Amendment protectors, okay? We are not afraid of terrorists, okay? Because I'm locked in stock. Okay, the left side of America,
you have a gun, and therefore you are not afraid of terrorists, David?
Believe me.
David, I don't want to take away your gun, first of all. Let me just disabuse you of that notion.
I
think this should be up to local communities. And number two, I find it mind-boggling. Do you think, David, are you of the opinion that the Second Amendment was passed so that if the government ever got oppressive, Americans could fight back against it? Is that your thought?
Absolutely not. America.
Why do you think the Second Amendment is there then? Why do you think the Second Amendment is there?
That's what the left side of America thinks. You believe that the government needs to protect us. I don't.
No. Wait a minute. The Second Amendment. David, why do you think we have the Second Amendment?
We have the Second Amendment so that we have to make sure that citizens can own, so we can keep a militia, and so we can protect ourselves against the British.
I agree with you. And most cons, most of you guys get it wrong. You know, most cons think that you've got the Second Amendment so that you can have a gun to fight back against the government should it ever become oppressive. And if that was the case, the Second Amendment would have said you also have the right to own a cannon. And you also have the right to own a battleship. Actually, the reason for the Second Amendment is because Jefferson, who helped write it, opposed having a standing army during time of peace. Because he said they are agents of mischief. David, thanks for the call. I really appreciate it when conservatives call, take me on. We'll continue this conversation after the break. It's 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. You are right here smack dab in the middle of the vast radical middle conspiracy. Sometimes characterized in other ways, I suppose.
So, all those clowns over at the liberal radio network, we could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains? Because they, you know, they're undermining everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. By the way, last night, went to see the movie Munich. Didn't realize it was going to run almost 3 hours. I got to tell you, this is an amazing piece of filmmaking. It's an absolutely amazing piece of filmmaking. And I've been reading the anti-Munich movie rants, and I've been reading the pro-Munich movie rants, but, you know, from the political points of view of it, and the Israeli-Palestinian debate whatever you want to call it. But I got to tell you, it's just an absolutely brilliant, and I thought startlingly even-handed, piece of cinematography. Steven Spielberg, another masterpiece. I mean, this is worthy of Schindler's List. I mean, this is absolutely brilliant. And in the newspaper yesterday, Reuters reports, and for those of you who've seen the movie, this will come as a shock. For those of you who haven't seen the movie, remember this when you go see the movie. The Palestinian mastermind of the Munich Olympics attack in which 11 Israeli athletes died, said on Tuesday he had no regrets and that Steven Spielberg's new film about the incident would not deliver reconciliation. Spielberg has called the movie his prayer for peace between Palestinians and Israelis. Mohammed Daoud planned the Munich attack on behalf of PLO splinter group Black September, but did not take part and does not feature in the film. He voiced outrage at not being consulted for the movie. the guys in Damascus, Syria, which is probably going to give Bush another reason to go to war in Syria in 2006 so that he can, you know, have another war so that he can get himself, you know, or he can get the Republicans elected again. And Daoud also says he has not seen the film. So, anyhow, that's but after the movie, I went to see it. Louise, my wife, and I went to see it with our son, Justin, and he, who was visiting from college. And Justin made the comment as we were leaving. He said, you know, most people just don't realize how tied all of this stuff, and not just, you know, the attacks in Munich in 1972 were, but the war in Iraq right now, how it's all tied back to World War One. It all goes back to World War One. And World War One was when the Ottoman Empire was busted up, was defeated, when three different states of the Ottoman Empire were cobbled together by the British because they represented some oil wealth and they thought that they could control them more easily that way. These three states then were given the name of Iraq. And of course, after World War One, the Treaty of Versailles imposed these enormous, huge financial burdens on Germany. Well, I say burden, I guess that implies a value judgment. Penalties on Germany for their behavior in World War One, and war reparations. And Germany, and since the payments were denominated in marks, they said you had to pay back a certain number of Deutschmarks. Germany said, okay, cool, we'll just make our marks worth nothing. And they ran the printing presses, you know, night and day so that they could pay back the war reparations with a devalued mark. And a lot of people concerned that Bush is doing the same thing, by the way, now that we have an $8 trillion debt in the United States thanks to trickle-down, insane trickle-down economics, Reagan and Bush. But that's a whole other topic. And that economic debacle that happened in Germany in the 20s as a consequence of the Treaty of Versailles, which came out of World War One, was directly, you know, led directly to the rise of Hitler, which then led to World War Two, which then led to the creation of the Israeli state, which then, I mean, it's amazing how it all comes around. And so I asked Justin, I said, you know, what do you think was the cause of World War One? I mean, everybody knows that Archduke Ferdinand of the Austro-Hungarian Empire was visiting Sarajevo, and this loony guy shot him, assassinated him. And, you know, one country had, there, all these different countries had these interlocking, if somebody attacks you, then it's as if they attacked us, kind of mutual defense agreements. And so Europe fell like dominoes in World War One. But to this day, I can't find anybody who can explain to me exactly why World War One happened. Beyond that, it was, you know, like a dumb mistake. And certainly I can't find anybody who can explain to me exactly why the United States entered World War One. The Republicans were very strongly opposed to our entering World War One. Woodrow Wilson was the Democratic president at the time, and he was elected largely by fluke because, as a Democrat, because the Republicans essentially controlled the Gilded Age, you know, from the 1870s right up through the Great Depression. And the way that Wilson got in was because Teddy Roosevelt decided to get into the race as a third-party candidate, the Bull Moose Party, and he was a progressive. And so, you know, he was splitting away from the Republicans. But anyway, I'm revisiting World War One here, but the question in my mind, I'm going to go back and read. I have Charles and Mary Beard's History of America, which was written in the 1928-1929 period. I'm going to go back and read the history of World War One. And if any of you know of any good histories of World War One, succinct, I'd love to hear them or read them. I asked Justin, what do you think caused World War One? And he said, I think it was an excess of peace. And I thought that's an interesting observation. I've certainly heard people say an excess of peace and there's profits to be made. By the way, if you don't like the facts, just make stuff up. This is absolutely incredible. There is this group called Move America Forward, a new right-wing group. And they sponsored a bunch of six, specifically, right-wing talk radio hosts to go over to Iraq and report on the wonders of the job that we're doing there. Which, by the way, we are doing a lot of good things in Iraq, and I think it would be marvelous if we did things like that all over the world, building schools and building hospitals, if we hadn't blown them up in the first place. And, but, you know, I digress. And one of those talk show hosts, one of the people who went over there, just happened to run into Ms. Morgan, just happened to run into a fellow that she identifies as an Iraqi general named Abdul Qudar Jassim. And she says that the General Jassim showed her documents proving that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. Now, from today's Wall Street Journal, quote, it couldn't be ascertained that Mr. Jassim is a general and he couldn't be reached for comment. So, I mean, we've got the word of one talk show host who says that she talked to a guy who says he's a general and nobody can even confirm he's a general, and he told her that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. On the basis of this, this group is running television ads all across America saying, and I quote, newly found Iraqi documents show that Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction, including anthrax and mustard gas, and had extensive ties to Al-Qaeda. The discoveries are being covered up by those willing to undermine support for the war on terrorism to selfishly advance their shameless political ambitions. End quote. If you don't like the facts, just make stuff up. It's right there in today's Wall Street Journal. It's absolutely incredible. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Pete in the Queens, New York. Hey, Pete, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, thanks. Tom, I think I'm sure you probably know this, actually, but, I mean, the mainstream reason that's accepted that the Americans entered into World War One was the sinking of the passenger vessel.
The Lusitania. Yeah.
And, you know, unfettered submarine warfare in international waters. Does that ring a bell with you?
It does. Yeah, I remember the sinking of the Lusitania. I mean, I don't remember personally the sinking of the Lusitania, but...
Yeah, but however, even though we claimed it was a British passenger vessel, I think the Germans claimed that we were actually shipping weaponry on that.
Yeah.
However, I wanted to debunk your other caller's point about your demographic.
Okay, yeah. We have 1 minute left, by the way.
Okay, I'll do it very quickly. And he brings in the fact about... he said that he's not gay. He brings that in. You know, it just goes to show how Bush was able to use the gay marriage issue to say that, you know, Republican, if you're anti-gay or against gay marriage, you'll vote Republican. And that separated working class people from other working class
people. Yeah, the guy's proclaiming himself as a bigot, basically.
Yeah, really, exactly. That's it, Tom.
Yeah,
well,
okay.
Thanks for your time.
Thanks a lot, Pete. Good to hear
Take
from
care,
you.
Buddy.
Bob in Mendocino, California, we got a half a minute. You got something to say?
Yes, sir. Good morning. There's one thing that we should all fear, and nobody really addresses it, and at least leaders don't, and that's climate change. I really believe we need a leader that can step forward and say, look, this affects everybody. I don't care your religion, your race, your economic status. If we don't do some planning and we don't do some coherent thinking now, we're going to face a disaster that's going to make all these wars look like child play.
I agree absolutely with you, Bob. And you know who's out there saying that literally every single day in front of groups all over the United States? Al Gore.
All right. Well,
and he's doing a brilliant job of it. He's doing an absolutely brilliant job of it. And I think that he would make a great president of the United States. The best president of the United States who was never president of the United States, who was actually elected president of the United States. But that's a whole other thing right there. 16, thanks for the call, Bob. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour, the place where reason is our lifestyle choice. Today, the Knight Ridder News Service, Tom Lasseter. Talking about the Iraqi army. Some troops that are under U.S. and Iraqi command are preparing to protect territory and ethnic and religious interests in the event of Iraq's fragmentation, which many of them say is inevitable. The soldiers said that although they wear Iraqi army uniforms, they consider themselves members of the Peshmerga, the Kurdish militia, and are awaiting orders from Kurdish leaders to break ranks. Many said they wouldn't hesitate to kill their Iraqi army comrades, especially Arabs, if a fight for an independent Kurdistan erupted. Pretty amazing, eh? I'm telling you, the Civil War started with the vote. The Civil War in Iraq started with the vote. There's a photo here, a Knight Ridder News Service photo of some Peshmerga troops with the Iraqi flag the Kurdistan flag, Kurdistan Democratic Party flag in the background. Those of you who've read my book Prophet's Way know an old and dear friend of mine, Gottfried Mueller, who is now 94 years old, lives in Germany. He's the guy I was visiting 2 weeks ago when I took a Friday and Monday off and made a weekend trip to Germany. Designed that flag. He was in Hitler's army and parachuted, and his brother was engaged in anti-war activity, anti-Hitler activity. And my friend was, basically kind of drafted into the army. And because he spoke several languages, including several Middle Eastern languages, and they wanted to take the oil fields from the British on behalf of the Kurds, parachuted into, he ultimately was betrayed because of his brother's activities, and they parachuted him into a British camp where he was immediately captured and sentenced to death, and that's where he spent the rest of the war. And he was so moved by that experience. He said, thanks to God, I never had an opportunity to kill anybody. I was never in combat. He was arrested as a spy and sentenced to death by firing squad by the British and by hanging by the Iranians, who controlled the territory at that time, and spent the rest of the war in a prison cell. And when he came back, started the social work, which is now known as Kinder and Jugend Hilfswerk Salem, works all around the world that I've done volunteer work with for 27 years. But his job was to help the Kurds separate themselves from the rest of Iraq that was then controlled by the Brits, so that the oil could go to Hitler. And he designed the flag. It's amazing. And another good friend of mine, Horst von Heyer, went down there 1980, I guess it was, or 1990 rather, when George W. Bush declared the no-fly zone and said he was going to kick a little Baghdad butt. Went down and got 36 bullets in his car. And Gerhard Liebfert, a mutual friend of ours, had to smuggle him out of the country. I went over to Germany to meet him. Anyhow, long stories. We've told them in some of our books, so no need to repeat them. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Tom. Have a happy and safe New Year.
Thank you, and the same to you and your family, Gary.
Thank you. I don't know. Maybe we're on the same wavelength, if you will. Maybe we're not, but you talked about Al Gore, my favorite, obviously.
I think
to be objective,
president.
I just think the momentum, if you will, the way it could play out, the momentum is going to come his way.
Al Gore's way?
Yes.
Yeah, I think so, too. I absolutely do. And, in fact, and Gary, thanks for the call, and thanks for pointing that out. I'm all in favor of a draft Gore movement. I think an Al Gore-Barbara Boxer ticket would be awesome, or vice versa, although, frankly, I think Al Gore should be at the top of the ticket simply because he did win last time, or a Barbara Boxer, Russ Feingold, or Russ Feingold, Barbara Boxer. I mean, there are so many good progressives out there. Jack in Byron, California. Hey, Jack, welcome to the program. Jack? Jack's not there. David in St. Augustine, Florida. Hey, David, welcome to the program.
Yes, hello, Tom Hartman. How are you doing today?
I am just great, but I'll get better. What's
good
up, David?
Happy holidays to you. That's
well,
better than anyone.
Thank you.
Holly bushes.
There you go.
Listen, about that caller earlier, talking about the weapons and stuff. And
yeah.
I own a hunting rifle and a shotgun, but I'm under no illusion whatsoever that could adequately protect me from, in a self-defense posture from these idiots running our government.
Yeah, it didn't work for David Koresh.
Yeah, exactly. And but it is better than nothing. I mean, if they kick your door in, it's less likely they'll kick your door in, and passives need to understand this. It's less likely they'll kick your door in if they know you're armed. So I'll leave that up there.
Okay.
Now, back to the U.S. government.
Yeah.
First of all,
we have just about a half a minute left, David. You got to keep it tight here.
Well, they're an illegitimate government. they shouldn't be in there in the first place. We know the 2000 election was clearly stolen. It's likely the 2004 election was stolen in Ohio. They just did a test in Leon County, Florida on die ball machines.
Yep, we reported it here on this program last week.
Yeah, easily hacked into. Very shocking.
And it's happened now in several other places. St. Louis County and St. Louis just dumped the machines. Other communities in Florida are dumping these machines. Not only Diebold, by the way, ESNS machines are coming under question. A lot of folks looking at this going, what's the deal? But I got to tell you, the Republican fraud went way beyond electronic voting machines. In fact, even without the electronic voting machines, you can document enough fraud to show that the election was stolen. But that's, as I said, a whole other show. We've done that before. We will come back and do it again. It's 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be back.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Have a nice day. Have a nice day.
And welcome back, my friends. It's the pill that will help you escape the matrix. The Tom Hartman radio program, 34 minutes past the hour, or 25 minutes before the hour, coming up on thereof. Whether you're an hour half past or an hour almost coming, there's some glass half full of variation on that. Anyhow, welcome back to the program. Alec DeBro is with us. He's with the International Labor Communications Association, the media coordinator for ILCA, otherwise known as ILCA, ILCAonline.org, the website. And Alec, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am just great. Alec, a lot to talk about today. I wanted to start out, though, with this op-ed that is in today's New York Times, because I suspect a lot of people have read it, and I know it's flying around in the blogosphere. I haven't been able to figure out if this is a rant from some right-winger who is trying to portray unions as, you know, kind of corrupt bumblers,
mm-hmm.
or if this is, you know, representing a real, I don't want to say weakness, but perhaps a strategic blunder on the part of at least the UAW. Here's the bottom line of it's titled "Big Labor's Big Secret" by Robert Fitch, and basically it says that everybody knows that we should have single payer health care in the United States. It would make us competitive with other countries. Toyota just moved a auto factory to Canada specifically because they couldn't afford the health care here. But big labor's opposed to it. And the reason they're opposed to it is because in some cases they get to control some of the money that's involved with or take responsibility for or just take credit for the health benefits, and they don't want to give up that power. What's your take on this?
Well, it's kind of a slashing, free-swinging, ignorant attack that has an element of truth in it. There was the particular scandal he talked about was the ULICO, Union Labor Health Insurance Company, involving one of the officials at the AFL-CIO. And there's no doubt that people, you know, that bureaucracies have furious staying power, and then some people profit from this. But to say that the labor movement is the primary impediment to instituting a single-payer health plan is just flat wrong.
Yeah, well, he's the tags at the end of the...
I was a union rep for the Communications Workers Association when Clinton came into office, and I was assigned to go out to the work sites and talk to people about supporting single-payer, which is what CWA wanted to do, despite the fact that it had its own health plan.
Yeah.
The reason it didn't succeed is because every time I started to talk about it, the workers booed me off the stage.
Because they've been listening to Rush Limbaugh.
They don't want it. I mean, this was the most bizarre thing. I was working with public workers, and they said they didn't want the government getting their hands on their health care.
Mm. Yeah, they've been watching too many of those Harry and Louise ads.
I may have overstated it.
I think this guy's overstating it. I mean, the author of this piece in today's New York Times, it says he's also the author of the forthcoming book Solidarity for Sale, How Corruption Destroyed the Labor Movement and Undermined America's Promise. It's hard to know, you know, exactly where he's coming from, but the issue, I mean, has labor taken a position at the highest levels for or against national health care?
It supported every progressive health care issue that's come along. I mean, Medicare would never have passed had it not been the AFL-CIO, for the AFL-CIO and the unions. I mean, none of that stuff would have.
You know, so the guy's a little off.
Not to say there is no corruption. I mean, in a movement of 13 million, you're going to have some. I mean,
sure.
There's no question about it.
Yeah, it's not unlike, it's not like saying, gee, every company in America has got its hands clean, too.
Let's
talk about the split in the AFL-CIO and the Change to Win coalition and all that. What's happening with that today?
Well, it's very interesting. I was just listening before it came on to Workers Independent News talking about it. But to me, the really interesting thing is that it was the most covered issue in labor this year. I've never seen so many reporters swarming around during the AFL-CIO convention in July.
Mm-hmm.
The moment it happened, they dropped it like a hot potato. When Change to Win had their founding convention, I think the New York Times story was like on page 10 or something like that. It really wasn't well covered. And since then, we really haven't heard a word about it. And it's kind of fascinating, and in part because of what Change to Win has done or not done since then.
Yeah.
Until last week, when Change to Win posted a statement about the transit strike in New York, they hadn't changed their website in 6 weeks.
That was really their first major official position on an issue, on a labor issue, wasn't it?
As far as I know, the other ones were rather bland support of workers' rights in general, something like that.
Right.
And the talk around is that that Change to Win has run into problems. Now, whether they're permanent or temporary, nobody knows, but that it's much easier to effect a split than it is to create another coalition.
Yeah, and now we should,
functioning independently.
In the interest of full disclosure, we should point out that the International Labor Communications Association, which you're the media coordinator of, and whose website is ilcaonline.org, is affiliated with the AFL-CIO.
That's correct. We are an independent institute of the AFL-CIO, but we are independent to the extent that we have many of the Change to Win locals and internationals in our membership. We are not. We have not expelled them, nor are we required to.
Right.
So we attempt to maintain some sort of even-handedness.
Right.
Although I guess being in the building, I get more criticism of them than I do support. But
do you think they're going to make it?
I don't see them coming back anytime soon. Let's put it that way. Will they succeed as a coalition? You know, as Sam Goldwyn said, predictions are difficult, especially about the future.
Yeah.
You know, I really don't know. I mean, this, for me in my lifetime, this is a new thing, and I can't guess. It really it depends on how much the various components in it, which seem like an odd group in some ways, are willing to compromise and create a coalition.
Yeah.
And that depends on leadership in large part.
Now, speaking of leadership, there was substantial leadership in California, both from AFL-affiliated unions and from Change to Win-affiliated unions, against Arnold Schwarzenegger in November.
To me, this is the most positive labor story that came out of this year. It was, and it was, as a matter of fact, a cooperation between SEIU, which is arguably the most powerful labor union in California, but the agglomeration of public worker unions, almost all of which are AFL-CIO, was the real spark plug.
Whereas SEIU, Service Employees International Union, is Change to Win, are they not?
Exactly.
Yeah, so here we have this merging of these two.
But
against Schwarzenegger.
Schwarzenegger just blundered into this. The one fascinating thing I heard, and I may have said this on the show before, was that reportedly Republican operatives in California said they had tried for years to figure out how to attack the teachers' unions and the nurses' unions without attacking the teachers and nurses, and concluded that it couldn't be done, and that simply do not use the issue this way. But Schwarzenegger, being a larger-than-life person, said, well, you failed, I'll succeed, I'm going to attack them.
And he got his butt kicked.
And kept calling them special interests until he really believed that he just simply repeated often enough, people will believe it. Now, that's sometimes true, but in this case, I just got the statistics on what the unions did for this, besides doing a wonderful organizing job. They spent over $100 million.
Wow.
And, you know, that's $100 million that could be used for a lot better purposes than fighting a, you know, a rear guard action against a right-wing set of initiatives, but that's what they were forced to do.
Yeah, yeah. So, now, speaking of you know, fighting and fighting initiatives, in New York City we had the transit workers' strike. It is still unresolved as we speak.
No. Today it finally, well, the workers, the members have not voted on it, but the executive board voted 37-4 to approve a tentative 37-month contract.
That's great news.
In it, the MTA, the Metropolitan...
Well, I guess I should ask, is that great news?
The MTA?
Yeah, no, that they, you know, is this a decent contract that they voted for?
Like all compromises, yes and no.
Right.
I mean, the sticking point, the thing that the union claimed was the spark plug that pushed them into the strike, which was the pension givebacks, the management dropped it.
Right.
But in turn, the union had to accept larger co-pays on health insurance.
Now, do you expect the rank and file are going to vote for this? Do you think it's going to be ratified?
I think they will. I think that strike itself was so angry and so painful for everybody that I think the workers are going to have to pay 1.5% of their wages toward premiums. Now, 1.5% is not nothing, but they're being fined $1,000 a day for the strike, and they have to evaluate whether this is worth it. My guess is what could have happened to them didn't happen to them as a result of the strike. This is a small price to pay. They probably will approve it.
This is a victory for labor in the United States overall.
I would say so, and it's a very interesting victory in that it really did not have public support. But what it had, you know, sometimes, as Machiavelli said, it's better to be feared than to be loved.
Yeah.
And in this case, people found out that striking transit workers have teeth. I mean,
there you go.
A three-day strike is going to be extremely painful, maybe to the transit workers worst of all, but to everybody.
Yeah, time to pay attention to labor. They had to resolve this thing. We've been talking with Alec DeBro. He's the media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association, ILCAonline.org. Thanks, Alec.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Oh, Sergeant, I'm a draftee and I've just arrived in camp. I've come to wear the uniform and join the martial tramp. And I want to do my duty, but one thing I do implore. You must give me lessons, Sergeant, for I've never killed before. Do my job obediently is all that I desire. To learn my weapon thoroughly in how to aim and fire. To learn to kill the enemy and then to slaughter more. Oh, I'll need instruction, Sergeant, for I've never killed before.
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number, Tom in Minneapolis on the line. Hey, Tom, welcome to the program.
Hey, happy holidays.
Well, and the same to you, Tom.
Thanks. Got a quickie question for you on Gore.
Sure.
Since in 2000, Gore chose, you know, Zell Miller clone Lieberman, Benedict Arnold.
Right.
Why are you so high on him?
Well, I'm willing to assume that was a mistake, an aberration,
colossal.
Yeah, I would call it that, and I think that we should all be allowed at least one colossal mistake in our lives. I know I've made a few. I'm guessing that you have. I think that...
that's what makes me skittish about Gore. I think, man, or did the DLCers force Gore to do that?
Well, we don't know. I mean, we just don't know the political equation there. You know, or was that his concession to Clinton? You know, who knows?
Do you think he's populist enough? Because Edwards seems to be more populist than Gore.
Yeah. You know, Gore has really, really come a long way. I mean, he's said some really remarkable things lately. And I just yeah, I here's the thing. I went to hear Al Gore here in Portland back, must have been about 2 months ago. I was talking about global warming.
Yeah.
And he was just, it was a barn burner speech. I mean, the guy was just incredible. And I am convinced that he would make a great, not just a great president, but a great candidate. And I think the whole thing about his being wooden and all that, a lot of it was just a media meme. You see him in person, and it's a very different thing.
Right.
And so
which is the real Gore, the one that shows the Zell Miller clone or the one that talks like a populist?
I think it's the one that talks like a populist. It's more consistent with the way that Al Gore has been throughout his time in the Senate. I think that his picking Lieberman as his campaign, as his vice presidential candidate was an aberration, frankly. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I'm willing to pass on that. In fact, you know, here's Al Gore. He's talking about George Bush betraying America. This is from February 8th of last year.
Because I think there were millions just like me who genuinely, in spite of whatever partisanship they may have felt prior to that time, genuinely felt like they wanted George W. Bush to lead all of us in America wisely and well. And
he's talking about right after 2000 now, or right after 9/11, excuse me.
The reason I'm recalling those feelings now is because those are the feelings that were betrayed by this president.
And it's just, you know, he talks like this. And
betrayed this country. He played on our fears.
And he can just give a rip-roaring speech these days.
He took America. He took America on an ill-conceived foreign adventure, dangerous to our troops, an adventure that was preordained and planned before 9/11 ever took place.
And they're, you know, just coming right out and talking about the project for a new American century, planned before 9/11 ever even took place. You know, he played with our emotions. I mean, this is Al Gore, and he wasn't running for anything. He's just speaking his truth.
So whether it's the economy, where he said he'd be a moderate, or social policy, where he said he'd be middle of the road, compassionate, or foreign policy and military policy, I will say to the president that it is not a minor matter to take the loyalty and deep patriotic feelings of the American people and trifle with them for purposes that are not in the best traditions of America. And so I say to you in closing, my friends, in the year 2004, the truth shall rise again.
There you go. Well, as I said, this is from February 8th. 2004, so, you know, hoping the truth would rise. And I think the truth will rise again. Jason in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Jason, just got a minute or two left. What's up?
Yeah, just real quick, just wanted to kind of give a rebuttal to some of Jason or Evan.
Evan, yeah. Said, yeah.
Yeah, some of his comments. I mean, you know, of course, he doesn't have any, he was saying that he didn't have any knowledge of, like, some issues affecting class and economics and things like that, but of course he wouldn't because, you know, being a conservative, he's, like, trapped in a certain mindset, you know, as are all conservatives, Republicans, of that neocon ilk. And, you know, if he's not concerned or aware of that stuff, you know, if his issues are mainly to, like, the rich white elite, you know, which a lot of them are concerned with.
Or the paranoid blue-collar across all races in America who are afraid of gays or who are afraid of godless communists or who are afraid of people of religions other than Christianity.
Right. And if they don't have any sort of awareness of those issues, you know, the only thing that they, and like all of us, you know, if we're only familiar with a certain, you know, set of understandings that we have and don't venture beyond that, then, you know, that's where we're stuck.
Yeah, yeah, you're right.
People have
and
to expand their thinking, you know, their awareness. That's the only way that they can start to see across the lines and see across the propaganda.
Jason, you're speaking with compassion and insight. You must be a liberal.
And thank you for what you're doing. Thank
okay.
You.
Thanks, Jason, and thanks for listening to us there on WTKT, WTKG in Grand Rapids, Michigan. It's
Boy, it's been a long morning. Good morning. And we will be back, by the way, here for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity on the Tom Hartman radio program, where being progressive never felt so good.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Exposing the con in conservative. Tom Hartman here with you. 6 minutes past the hour. Pension problems loom for boomers. Headlines in today's USA Today, risky home loans rise, house price bubble inflates, the editorial, lead editorial, budget deal could increase deficit. And then there's a little piece of this that connects to the airlines as well. We'll get to that in a minute. But first of all, the overview. Bush keeps telling us that the Bush administration, and for that matter, a lot of the mainstream media keep telling us, you know, everything's just fine with the economy. The economic growth is doing it. GDP grew and everything is going. And if you are a millionaire or a billionaire, that is true. It is absolutely true. The economy is doing just great for the millionaires and the billionaires among us. Just fine. It's doing really well for those people who make their money sitting on their butts around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive in the mail. Which is, you know, not insignificant portion of Bush's base. You know, let's acknowledge that. That's why he pushed through in his final tax cut, his third big tax cut during his first administration. He pushed through a reduction in the taxes on those people whose income is comprised of dividends, that is payments from corporations and the profits of corporations, from having to pay the same tax rate as you and me and the guy who cleans the streets and the cop on the beat and the teacher in the school for that matter, even the CEO, the same tax rate maximum. I think it's around 35% now. Instead of that, the maximum amount of income tax that you have to pay if you're, for example, a member of the multimillionaire Bush family, or the multimillionaire Cheney family, or the multimillionaire Jon Snow family, or the multimillionaire Condoleezza Rice, any of these multimillionaire families, Colin Powell family now, if you're one of these families who is primarily living off income derived from investments, where most of your income is the dividend check that comes every month or every quarter or every 6 months or every year, then you pay a maximum income tax on that of 15%. We have created a caste system, C-A-S-T-E, like in India, and you have the five castes, you know, the Brahmins and the Untouchables and everything in between. We've created a caste system in the United States, and we've burned it into our Internal Revenue Service code. So, you know, if you're one of these guys like Rush Limbaugh, who, you know, got his 270-some-odd million bucks a few years ago, and you invest it in the market, and you're making most of your money now off dividends that are coming back, 15% income tax maximum with no Social Security payments. Whereas if you're a working stiff, if you're an average person, if you get a paycheck for a living, you got to pay the whole load. I mean, it's really, really quite remarkable. The Economic Policy Institute put together a piece by Lawrence Michael and Ross Eisenbury, the president and policy director, that just, you know, let's look at the economy here. This is sort of a snapshot from the end of 2005. Here we are at the end of the year. Last weekend was Christmas and the beginning of Hanukkah and the beginning of Kwanzaa. Next weekend is New Year's. So here we are at this kind of, you know, last week of the year. How is the economy doing? You know, Ronald Reagan's famous question when he ran against Jimmy Carter, are you better off today than you were 4 years ago?
Well, first of all, profits are up. If you look over the last 5 years, profits are up. Corporate profits, definitely up. But the wages and the incomes of average Americans, not quite. Inflation-adjusted hourly and weekly wages are still below where they were at the start of the recovery in November of 2001. I mean, if you want to see it, I mean, we're going to give it the benefit of the doubt and not even include the so-called recession of 2000 that essentially started officially in March of 2001 and ended in November of 2001, the first year of Bush's presidency. He came into office, announced his economic plans, and basically everybody in Wall Street said, oh, no, you got to be kidding. Okay. So inflation-adjusted hourly and weekly wages, whether you work on an hourly basis and you're paid by the hour or whether you are paid on a salary basis and paid weekly wages, you are making less than you were when you consider inflation. You are making less than you were in November of 2001. Yet productivity, that's the growth of the economic pie, up 13.5%, which raises the question, if the economy has grown by 13.5%, productivity is up 13.5%, why hasn't there been a similar growth in wages? Well, it turns out that 35%, let's just go back in history. Typically, when you have an increase in the economic pie, about 20%, more or less. In fact, the actual number, 22% on average, about a fifth of it, is distributed as profits to corporations and then distributed to individuals as dividends. So those people, you know, the Walton family, the Bush family, the Cheney family, those people who earn their living sitting on their butt waiting for the dividend check to arrive, or at least the bulk of their income, pay a maximum of only 15% taxes. So typically, 22% of productivity has gone to that chunk of the economy, to those people. Well, since Bush came into office, or since November 2001 specifically, it's gone up to 35%. As a result of this, median household income in the United States, and this is adjusted for inflation, so we're talking real dollars, median household income has fallen 5 years in a row and was 4% lower in 2004 than in 1999. Inflation adjusted, in 2004, the median household income in the United States, $44,389. But back in 99, in inflation-adjusted dollars, it was $46,129. We've lost, what is that, about $2,000? Almost $2,000 a year. That is not insignificant. Why? Because most of the growth in the economic pie has been sucked up and passed out to those people who live off corporate profits, those people who live off dividends. As a consequence of this, more and more Americans are going deeper in debt. When you look at average U.S. households, after adjusting for inflation, indebtedness, we heard Evan in the first hour of this program say, 70% of Americans are homeowners now. And I said, no, 70% of Americans are mortgage owners now. The indebtedness of U.S. households has risen 35.7% over the last 4 years. That's unprecedented. It's an explosion in debt. The level of debt as a percentage of after-tax income is the highest ever measured in the history of the United States. The last time it was this high? Just before the Great Depression. Mortgage and consumer debt is now 115% of after-tax income. Twice the level of when Reagan came into office and started all this economic madness. 115%. The debt service ratio, that's the percentage of after-tax income that goes to pay off your debts, the amount of money that after you've paid your taxes, you get your paycheck, you put that money in the bank, the amount of that money that people are using to pay for debt is now 13.5%. This is at an all-time high. It has never before in the history of the United States been this high. Might have something to do with why the credit card companies lobbied for a bankruptcy bill. It makes it very, very difficult for people like you and me, average folks, to declare bankruptcy, people with, you know, middle-class incomes and whatnot, and yet makes it possible for millionaires and billionaires like Donald Trump to use bankruptcy and, you know, airlines to shed things like pension obligations or to move properties around or whatever. And the personal savings rate has gone negative for the first time since World War II. And World War II, I mean, you know, a significant sacrifice in World War II. People were living off their savings. We are now living off our savings. We are not adding to our savings. When you say the personal savings rate has gone negative, it means that we are now living off our savings. And this is a very scary thing. This is definitely not a healthy economy. And yet the millionaires that you see on TV, the talking heads who, you know, well, they're not all making a million, I mean, 500,000 a year, whatever. The guy, the well-paid people you see on TV, the talking heads, they say everything's fine. Well, everything is fine for them, for people in those income categories. But for the average person in America, we had some serious problems. 16 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
I could talk these words that will sound so sweet, they would even make your little heart skip a beat. Heal a sick, raise a dead, and make the little girls talk out of their heads. I'm the one.
And welcome back, my friends. It's the Tom Hartman radio program where despair is not an option. Get active! We got an election coming up in just 11 months. It is not too early to start getting active. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466, 440-THOM. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to tomhartman.com and drop in, say hi. Although it seems that something funky has happened over there. I'm going to have to bounce back in to the folks in the chat room. Hey, I got bounced out. I'll have to bounce back in during the next break. Poverty. In the United States, I want to get back to some of these statistics, and then take a couple of your phone calls. And the thing to keep in mind is these are not just like, you know, boring statistics. Oh no, it's statistics. No, it's not. This is the real state of the American economy. Job creation. The Bushies are running around talking. Well, look at all the jobs we created. Last month we created over 130,000 jobs. Yeah, except 57,000 of them were in the private sector, and you have to create 115,000 jobs just to keep up with the number of new people coming into the job, into the labor force every month. Well, where'd all those other jobs get created? Well, those were government jobs. That was folks going to work for Halliburton and going over to Iraq and joining the army and rebuilding, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So the reality is the job creation, well, even when you include government spending, has not kept up with population growth. And the employment rate has actually fallen sharply. Today, we only have 1.3% more jobs than we did in March of 2001. Private sector jobs up only 0.8%. If you look at previous business cycles, if you look at, you know, similar four-year periods where you're recovering from a recession, over that same four-year snapshot, keep in mind, our job creation under Bush with his trickle-down economics and supply-side voodoo economics, private sector jobs up 0.8%, typically. And this goes all the way back to essentially the last years of the Great Depression. Typically, jobs had grown by an average of 8.8%. You say, well, that's average, right? Certainly there have been bad years. I mean, Bush only had 0.8%, but at least he's growing something. I'm sorry, it has never, since 1934, it has never been less than 6%. The unemployment rate is at a relatively low 5%, but it's still higher than 4% in 2000. In other words, we have, you know, more unemployed people now than we did in the last year of the Clinton administration. Surprise, surprise. I think anybody who remembers
People say, but I don't want to pay taxes. I'd be glad to pay Bill Clinton's taxes if I had Bill Clinton's economy. Putting away a surplus, paying down the national debt, not dumping debt on my children and my grandchildren. Sure. Easy. Good jobs. The percent of the population that has a job has never recovered since the recession and is still 1.3% lower than in March of 2001. In fact, if we were simply to go back to the number of people who had jobs before November of 2001, you know, before Bush, 3 million more people would be employed right now. Which just happens to coincide with the 3 million manufacturing jobs that have been lost since George Bush came into office. What's the result of this? What's the bottom line on this? Poverty on the rise. Poverty up from 11.3%. Now, this is amazing. In 2000, I mean, that's pretty grim to begin with, that more than 1 in 10 Americans is living in poverty. It's now 12.7%. That's more than the number of people living in poverty has increased by 5.4 million people. Where is our horror at this? Child poverty in the United States. When George Bush came into office, it was at 16.2%. It's now at 17.8%. Where is our outrage at this? Where are our values? We have today 17.8% of American children living in poverty. And the Bushies, their response to this is to pass a budget bill that slashes the ability of divorced women, by and large, to recover child support payments. Cut $1.5 billion from that. How can you pull yourself up by your bootstraps if you don't have any bootstraps to begin with? It's just a fundamental concept here. Rising health care costs, wiping out our already declining income. As we've documented, the income for the average American has been going down ever since George Bush came into office in inflation-adjusted dollars. And on top of that, we're spending more on health care. Family health care rose 43 to 45% for married couples with children. 45% in just 3 years from 2000 to 2003. Nearly 3.7 million employed people lost their insurance because their employer said, no, we're not doing that anymore. Incredible. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Passion for the warriors, whose strength is not defined. Flashing for the refugees on the unarmed road of flight. And for each and every underdog soldier in the night. And we gazed upon the chimes of freedom flashing.
Indeed, freedom flashing, coming back to the United States of America, my friends. Only you and I can bring democracy back to this nation, and only by getting politically active, by participating, by getting out there and showing up and speaking out. You know, enough of this just sitting around going, oh, woe is me, I can't do anything. The Republicans, they're just so corrupt. They've got all the money. Sorry. No, it's and this is not a blame the victim thing, but we the people are the ones who should have the power and need to take it back. Just to wrap up this, I just want to wrap up this economic thing here very quickly. Employers are cutting back on health insurance. Last year, the percentage of people with employer-provided health insurance fell for the fourth year in a row. Why has all these things happened just since George W. Bush became president? Why? Well, because they're consistent with his policies. You know, compassionate conservatism. The screaming headline in the papers today, U.S. programs use half of money. Associated Press, entitlements to keep growing faster. Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security are using up half the federal budget, they shout. Is this bad? I think this might be a very good thing. We've got a very large insurance company here that operates in a very transparent way that's answerable to we the people, that nobody's skimming money off the top of. Social Security has never failed to make a payment. I see this as a good thing. And if that's half the budget of the United States, that means that we're not spending money on you know, other absurd things. That's fine with me. But, you know, tragically, our health insurance, you know, a good chunk of it is provided by employers. Last year, the percentage of people with employer-provided health insurance fell for the fourth year in a row. Nearly 3.7 million fewer people. 3.7 million fewer people had employer-provided health insurance in 2004 than in 2000. This had, you know, the wonders of Bushonomics and Bush's insane trade policies, following on Clinton's insane trade policies, by the way, with NAFTA and GATT and the WTO and all this voodoo trade, repudiating over 200 years in the United States of building strong domestic industries using tariffs to protect domestic industries. Reagan, Bush, Clinton, Bush kicked it out the window. And so now in the last 4 years, we've lost 3 million manufacturing jobs. And just by coincidence, 3.7 million fewer people have employer-provided health insurance. Might be a correlation there. In fact, taking population growth into account, if the number of people having employer-provided health insurance right today was the exact same percentage of the population as it was in 2000, 11 million more people would have employer-provided health insurance. Instead, we have 3.7 million fewer. That's, you know, a net loss of what should be to what is of 14.5 million people and having health insurance. And that, by the way, is just the beginning of my folder about economics. We'll get into that. I've got a bit of a everything you know is wrong here thing for you. First, Fran in Los Angeles. Our telephone number, 866-440-THOM, 440-8466. Hey, Fran, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you, Tom?
I am great, but I'll get better, Fran. What's on your mind today?
Well, I wanted to respond to what you were saying about Al Gore, because I saw him in L.A., and he did do an amazing program. I really enjoyed him.
You saw one of his recent presentations on global warming?
I did. It was fantastic.
Yeah, they really are.
He did a great job. My fear, though, is that I think he'd make a great candidate. I think he'd make a great president. My fear is that with the current state of the media, they would take an impassioned and populist speech like the one that you played and turn it into the Howard Dean scream.
They're going to do that with any candidate, Fran.
Yeah.
I mean, Howard Dean was the candidate. If you look at the early pollings, Howard Dean was the candidate who had the greatest potential to bring down George W. Bush. He was the one who had the highest probability of winning against Bush. And Howard Dean was the candidate that was the only candidate in the Democratic primaries that the Republicans spent $1 million trying to bring down in the state of Iowa. They went into Iowa, they ran those, he's a latte-drinking, Volvo-driving liberal, we need to send him back to Vermont, those ads, remember those ads? They spent $1 million in this little state of Iowa on those ads to bring down Howard Dean. Why would the Republicans do that? Well, obviously, because they didn't want to run against Howard Dean. They thought they could beat John Kerry. They didn't think they could beat Howard Dean. This is not new, by the way. Richard Nixon did polling back long ago. I think it was the election of 72, and looked and said Ed Muskie could easily have beaten Richard Nixon. Ed Muskie, the senator from Maine, the Democratic senator from Maine. And so he sent his little band of merry tricksters out. And, in fact, Chuck Colson was part of this operation, as I recall. And they went to New Hampshire, and they stole some of Muskie's letterhead, and they forged this letter where he referred to the people of New Hampshire as Canucks, which is a slur on people of French ancestry, which is about half the population of the state of New Hampshire. And then the folklore is among the people who are involved in dirty tricks that they put some LSD or some other drug in Muskie's coffee, and Muskie gets up on the back of this flatbed truck, having been attacked on the front page of the Manchester Union Leader by its publisher at the time, William Loeb, who is now deceased, and you know, attacked for this phony letter, and everybody knew it was a phony letter, and he starts blithering about his wife, and he's like, he's tripping. I mean, he's up on the back of this truck, and it ended Muskie's career. Why would Nixon go to all that effort? Because he knew he could beat George McGovern. They had already done the polling, and he knew he could not beat Ed Muskie. The Republicans are very, very good at deciding who they're going to run against. Once the campaign starts, half of their work is already done.
I guess my question then is, how do progressives fight a media that is fighting them? I mean,
yeah,
there needs to be some strategy. Programs like yours are fantastic, but I think most people get their news from television.
I don't disagree, friend.
And
television is not entirely unresponsive, and I would suggest that, in fact, I've seen just in the last 2 years since Media Matters came along, David Brock's organization, with some funding from George Soros and others, which has been holding their feet to the fire a lot in many cases, I've seen a significant shift, a very significant shift in programs like Chris Matthews' Hardball, where he's gone from being extremely right-wing to just moderately right-wing. They just outed C-SPAN just a couple of weeks ago. They did a program where they looked at all the guests on C-SPAN, which is supposed to be totally neutral. I mean, C-SPAN is basically paid for with a tax or a fee that's attached to cable providers. It's the way of giving back for the use of the public rights of way the cables run on. And they found that something like 67%, 65% of all guests on C-SPAN were Republicans or conservative-leaning. And, you know, so as these numbers come out, as these kinds of things come out, you know, and particularly the stuff from Media Matters and from FAIR, the Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR.org, MediaMatters.org, people like you and I need to be taking these articles and calling up our local TV stations and calling the networks or emailing the networks and saying, hey, wait a minute, how about some fair and balanced coverage? And I'll tell you, the success of programs on television, for example, Amy Goodman's Democracy Now!, which is also on the radio, but it's you know, mainly television program, and the success of progressive radio programs from all across the spectrum. I mean, you know, from Ed Schultz on Jones to the folks on Air America. I mean, the whole thing is causing a lot of people to say, hey, wait a minute, have we gone too far? So I think that we just need to keep holding the feet of the media to the fire, Fran. That's what we need to be doing.
Great advice.
Thanks for the call. I appreciate
it. Thank you.
Good talking to you. Scott in Seattle, Washington. Scott, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Tom, great to talk to you.
Thanks. Thanks for calling, Scott.
Sure. I was calling because yesterday you gave out some numbers about the percentage and stuff like that of taxes that the super rich pay or the lack that they pay or whatever. And what I was getting at is, like, I have all these Republican friends and family who send me these like chain email letters, and if there was a way to post those numbers that you give out, it's really tough to find them on the internet.
Yeah.
Like if there was like a part of your website that said, here's like today's facts or whatever, that we could just shoot those right back at them. You know what I'm saying?
You'll find our listeners do that on a real regular basis on the message board over at TomHartman.com. There's one section called Economics, and there's an enormous amount of really great information there. And then there's another section dedicated to this national radio program where you'll find listings there. The information that I just shared with you a minute ago is from the Economic Policy Institute, and I believe that is EPI.org. No, I'm sorry. It's EPINET.org. EPINET.org. So, you know, there's a source for economic information. For
I mean, it's like they're hard to find. So I get driving at home, and I'm in the car, and then by the time I get home, I forget which website you mentioned.
Yeah.
And then when I get home, it's hard to remember what, you know, it's like.
I'm trying to get more often into my own message board and post these things, and I've been doing it with audio links and things. But frankly, it's just a matter of, you know, as the show gets larger and grows, we'll have more people doing this. But right now, there's only a dozen or so of us who are kind of working on this, many of us in sort of a semi-volunteer basis, making these things happen and running the message boards and whatnot. I encourage you to participate in the message boards. You'll find a lot of information there. You'll find a lot of pointers there. Drop into the chat room, too. The folks in the chat room are really good about, you know, somebody asks a question, they'll give you a link right away.
Okay, so, I'll try it.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Good to hear from you, Scott, and thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. It's 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where we dare to ask that eternal question, is Walmart a person? Should they have rights of persons? And we dare to say, no! No! I'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Hold on tight to your dreams.
Hold on tight to your dreams.
Indeed. That's what we got to do. Oh, my, because if we don't, I mean, you know, what else is there, right? Well, there's democracy in America. That was a dream. This all started, I mean, it's really amazing when you think about it. It all started as just an idea in somebody's mind. Just started out as an idea in somebody's mind. And here it is. Here you have, in 1989, you had 15,000 people marching into Tiananmen Square, many of them to their death, I don't know if most, but many of them to their imprisonment, carrying a 36-foot-tall papier-mâché statue, replica of the Statue of Liberty, renaming her the Goddess of Liberty, and quoting Thomas Jefferson and Thomas Paine. I mean, we have this extraordinary thing called a Republican democracy that we started 230-some-odd years ago. We just cannot allow a guy who thinks he has the right, the divine right of kings, to rip apart and shred our Constitution and throw it in our face the way this guy is. And then have Congress completely look the other way. You think this is strange. What you know about what's going on now compared to, well, you know, it's the old...
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Well, 2 weeks ago, George Bush admitted that he broke the law wiretapping U.S. citizens without warrants. Admitted it. Bragged about it. He appears to be saying that the reason why is noblesse oblige, that, you know, actually not even that, the divine right of kings. What did the Republicans in the Senate Judiciary Committee say? Well, they may hold oversight hearings into the matter. Flashback exactly 10 years. Exactly 10 years, well, more or less 10 years. 10 years ago, this week, Representative Dan Burton, Republican from Indiana, then chair of the House Government Reform and Oversight Committee, spent your tax dollars and mine to investigate Bill Clinton's cat. I kid you not, the Republicans investigated Bill Clinton's cat. Socks, remember the socks? They wanted to find out whether the cost for the stationery and the postage for the fan club dedicated to Bill Clinton's cat, socks, were being paid for by taxpayers. And so they took taxpayer money to find out that stationery and postage was, in fact, not being paid for by taxpayers, but was being paid for by private sources. By the way, Barbara Bush, Millie, remember? Dog, also has a fan club. Never been investigated. We don't know who's paying for the postage there. Tom in Sacramento, California, thanks for calling the program. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling about something you brought up earlier about how we got into the First World War.
Right. Not so much how, but why.
Well, no, the progression.
Yeah.
Okay, Lusitania. Wilson runs on basically we're not going to go into the war.
Right.
Meanwhile, we got all these war manufacturers making money from selling to Germany, England, France. Then, at a certain point, Wilson makes a decision somewhere late in 1916 where he wants to cut Germany off.
Right.
Getting munitions and whatever we're selling them. And that leads up to the Zimmerman telegram, which the British intercept and turn over to us, where the Germans are going to get Mexico to ally with them and invade us. And in theory, that's what broke the camel's back.
Oh, interesting. See, there are chunks of American history that I know very, very well. The Revolutionary era, for example. Well, I don't know World War One particularly well. And I've got to look at it. Here's Herbert Hoover, by the way, talking about how we got into World War One. This is, you know, the guy who was president afterwards,
well,
right?
Secretary of Commerce.
Right, and he was very opposed to this. Here, just listen to Herbert Hoover on this.
We ourselves, when we entered the war, imitated the others. We created great propaganda agencies. And no man dared to question or answer under that fierce organized condemnation.
And then he goes on to talk about how propaganda was used.
And here we can examine one of the methods of power politics, and that is propaganda. During the World War, propaganda was first developed into an actual weapon no less potent than the killing of men. When peoples and governments weigh the sacrifice of their sons, then truth and honesty and tolerance and justice are thrown to the winds if a lie will serve better.
Now, there's a Republican president taking to task Woodrow Wilson, the Democratic president, for lying us into World War One.
Well, Wilson, once he was determined, he was extremely, virtually fanatic.
Oh, I know. I used to own an ad agency.
He went from black to white.
I know. I used to own an ad agency, and I used to teach marketing. And when you go back and you look at the history of the public relations business, and it literally started with Woodrow Wilson. I mean, he essentially funded the creation of the of an entire public relations industry, the early research into how do you change people's minds.
Oh, by the way, I want to tell you I'm a Vermont boy.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
I lived there for 10 years. I just moved there for 17. Yeah, I just moved from there to Oregon here just in April of this year, and I miss it. So, and hope to go back soon.
Well,
Tom, thanks a lot for the call.
Thanks for the
info. I'm gonna have to go home and pull out my copy of the History of America by Charles and Mary Beard. This brilliant history, which I believe is still in print in some places anyway. In some way, you can certainly find used copies of it very easily. Published around 1928, 1929. Charles and Mary Beard, brilliant historians. Left-leaning, you could say. Mary Beard was one of the early uber-feminists. Or women's suffragettes was actually it was a negative term that was used back then. I'm not sure the exact phrase she would use to characterize herself. But anyhow, fascinating history. I'll fill you in on that as the week goes on. And check out the movie Munich. Remember, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.